It's time to meet up and catch up at the Weekend Water Cooler. Now, here's your host, Gene Bolduc.
Welcome to the Weekend Water Cooler. Joining me today is my host, my host. I'll be fine. Okay, let's just pause right there and maybe restart that. Joining me today is my host. I've been doing this for 4 years, and I don't think I ever did that, Jeff. Okay.
All right.
It's one reason we're not going live. All right. Jesus Christ. Welcome to the Weekend Water Cooler. Joining me today is Jeff Niemann, who is the Assistant District Attorney for Orange and Chatham Counties. That's a lot of ground to cover. We have a lot of ground to cover. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Good to be here, Gene. Good to be here.
Happy to have you. We're doing the Weekend Water Cooler at Home edition, as we have been for a good part of this year because of COVID. We're so grateful to Zoom. I feel like I should send them a thank you note because they've made it possible for me to continue doing this. So if listeners notice a little difference in the sound quality, it's because of COVID. Just blame COVID. That's what I say. So I wanted to talk to you today, Jeff, for two reasons. One, I think that in person, directly, person to person, I haven't talked to you since you were in the backseat of my car on the way to Bill Clinton's first inauguration.
I think that's right. 1993.
Yes, that's been a while. So I guess you grew up and stuff. And, you know, that's
at least
just full disclosure to everybody. That's how I came to know Jeff, that we were on this field trip for my son's class. Jeff was not in my son's class. He's a minute or two older. And we all went to Clinton's inauguration. And what an experience it was.
It was a wonderful experience in a very different time.
Boy, I'll say, man, oh, man, what a different time. We had, just so everybody knows, what an epic event this was. We had 9 cars in basically a Chapel Hill caravan that traveled to Washington the day before the inauguration. We stayed overnight, got up at the, I don't want to say, hour of the morning, the zero dark 30 hour of the morning to take the train into D.C. and watch the inauguration. It was plenty cold. Yep. And then I think we went to, I remember if we went to Arlington the next day. I think we did, maybe not. I think we did some of the sites the next day, but I honestly don't remember. I just remember slowly getting the feeling in my feet back over time on the way back. But that was quite an adventure. And, you know, everybody should go to a presidential inauguration at least once so that they appreciate never doing it again and, you know, and enjoy the benefits of watching it on television.
Agreed.
Which this year, I guess everybody will watch it on television, no matter who the next president is. They probably won't do the big outdoor thing. I mean, I wouldn't think so.
I think it might depend on who wins the election.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Anyway, because of COVID, I wanted to ask Jeff from a number of different perspectives how COVID is affecting the work that you do, because it's one of those things where an awful lot of what happens in court and probably with the district attorney's office requires that people be gathered in a room together. At least it has been that way. So, you know, jump in with whatever starting point you have to tell me, how in the world are you guys doing this in the world of COVID-19?
Sure. Well, when it first happened, I guess like most of the world, we had the kind of hard lockdown period where there was virtually nothing happening.
Right.
And that lasted between a month and 2 months where we didn't really have any court. There still had to be a minimal amount of court because when people get arrested, they have a right to have a first appearance. And so we were doing that and pretty much nothing else. boy, it does. It impacts all kinds of things, and it's not just court, the whole criminal justice system.
Right.
I'll start with the fact that our ability to, if you think of the court system as kind of like a bathtub, where, you know, and it's just the best analogy I can think of.
As I so often do, yeah.
Right. You know, and the cases coming in are like water coming in, filling the bathtub, right. And then the cases going out are like water coming out of the drain. And believe me, I don't, these are people, and I don't think of them like going down the drain, but it's just the analogy holds.
Right.
So one good thing that's helped is that while our ability to process cases out the end through the drain has slowed down, it's like the drain is clogged essentially.
Right.
So is the faucet. Cases are coming in at a lower rate. Arrests and charges are down significantly.
Now, do you feel like that? Let me stop you there and ask you: do you feel like that? That's something I've often wondered about. I thought, you know, if everybody's staying home, and I mean everybody, that certainly means that there are fewer traffic accidents, for example.
Yes.
That's an obvious thing right away. But I wondered too if there were fewer incidents of crime, basically, in the first few months, anyway.
I think one thing that probably people who don't work in the criminal justice system don't think of it this way. They probably expect that a larger portion of crime is, you know, four guys or four people sitting around a kitchen table plotting a scheme to go commit a crime.
Right?
it really isn't like that for the most part. Most crime is sort of spontaneous and opportunistic. It's the result of human beings being out in the world and literally or figuratively crashing into each other or contacting each other.
When
people generally aren't out and about in the world as much, less crime occurs. And then a lot of criminal charges arise from traffic stops and traffic. When there are fewer cars out on the road, that's going to mean fewer, and it's not just traffic-related crime. There's other things that occur from when people get stopped and then they end up having something in their car that's illegal or something else occurs. And there's just a lot less opportunity for there to be criminal charges. And the real crime rate is down in our district at least.
Wow.
And the incidence of crime being detected essentially is also down. So that's one effect, is that the cases are coming in at a slower rate. Another thing that has occurred, I guess, keeping with the bathtub analogy, another way to get water out of the tub might be to bail water out of the tub.
There's a whole courtroom bail play on words there. We're just leaving that alone.
and I'm not referencing specifically bail as in, but we can talk about that too, but one way to bail water out of the tub would be for us to simply dismiss cases.
Right.
And we did do that on kind of a large scale. We basically had to, you know, and prosecution and criminal work is about prioritizing. And we recognized that a big priority we had was to reduce the number of human beings who needed to come into the courtroom.
Right.
A very large portion of those bodies coming in are people for traffic tickets. And so what we did was we kind of set some priorities of some cases that we felt like we could afford to dismiss en masse. And mostly it was low-level regulatory type traffic offenses, expired registration,
speeding tickets,
license.
Right.
Well, and even speeding tickets, only on the lower end, because I think we do think that speeding is a public safety issue. And so we weren't dismissing speeding tickets at the high level. It was low-level speeding tickets. Low-level infractions. But that, in terms of numbers, that just took a huge number of the people coming in down. So it used to be that we'd have a traffic day where we'd have a docket of 600 and we'd have as many as 200-300 people coming into the courtroom.
Yes.
And I think, you know, in normal times, we run a pretty efficient ship of the way we order people coming in. And I know it's not a pleasant experience for people to do, but generally speaking, they're in and out in under about an hour in the normal times. Now those dockets are a fraction of what they used to be. We never have more than about a dozen people in the courtroom at any one time. And that's even in the big courtroom, including everybody. And this is a courtroom that has a capacity of 350 people. And we have it down to where it's never really more than 10 in the 10 to 15 person range. cooperation from a lot of different groups, like the clerk's office, the bailiffs, DA's office, all that helped make that work. So that has changed significantly. And there's more and more. I don't know where should you want me to just keep going?
Well, that's a good place for us to take a quick pause, and we'll come back with so much more with Jeff Neiman from the Orange and Chatham District Attorney's Office. Jeff is with us for the full hour. I can't wait to hear how some of these other issues are resolved. I've been very curious about this. Stay with us. You're listening to the Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back with Jeff Neiman, the ADA for Orange County, Orange and Chatham Counties. And just a quick point, Jeff, is do you, in normal times, do you split your time in the office between the two counties, or are you just based in one office and pretty much stay there?
Sure. So Jim Woodall, as you know, is the district attorney for the entire district, both counties. And there are 10 of us that are the assistant DAs, seven that are primarily stationed out of the Orange office and three out of the Chatham office. And in reality, for the most part, people stay in the county that is their home county. Although I have tried cases in Chatham County, and occasionally someone from Chatham will come. So I guess officially I'm an assistant over the whole district, but I primarily work in Orange.
But primarily Orange. And then would that be because the case kind of brought you over the border, or is it just a management thing?
No, the case is going to stay where it is. So the case, you know, if the case is going to be tried where the physical location where the crime allegedly occurred, what would get me down there most often is that they have a heavy traffic day and they need another hand on deck, and somebody from our office will go down just to help, you know, handle a traffic court day. But I've gone down there and tried a case in Superior Court because there was a similar thing where they needed somebody to finish a jury trial down there.
Right.
And we fill in other ways. So no, it's really just like a lot of other offices. It's just
It's just managing personnel back and forth. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about jury trials. You told me a moment ago that you really can't do them now. So what do you do with the cases when you can't hold a jury trial?
Yeah. So, I mean, the jury trial is the kind of the cornerstone of the criminal justice system, right? Everybody knows that. But what they might not know is that actually a very small percentage of cases actually get resolved by a jury trial. And the reason for that is I think I feel good about the fact that we have a good jury trial system in our county and people have the opportunity to have a trial. But the bottom line is that once you get to the level where a case is going to be tried in front of a jury, very often, most cases, especially felonies, the consequences are so high that there is a high incentive to find a compromise known as a plea agreement.
Right.
If somebody's facing an armed robbery offense, which usually carries at least a 5-year minimum prison sentence, the stakes are big. The outcome of a trial could be anywhere from persons found guilty and sent to prison for 5 or more years to found not guilty and they don't get any time. There's a lot of middle ground between those two. And so there's an incentive for both the state and the defendant to see if they can reach a middle ground agreement on that case and avoid sort of leaving it up to the risks of a trial from both sides.
Right.
That said, at least the presence of the possibility of a jury trial is what helps move that case forward. And when when you're in a circumstance like we are now where the jury, both sides know there's not at least an imminent possibility of a jury being brought in to try the case, that hurts the incentive from both sides to find that compromise. I'll get to what the effects of that are, but here's why we don't have jury trials is it's the one thing we're doing a lot of things like a lot of other business and government things by Zoom. And we actually use WebEx, but it's a similar program.
Right.
You can't really have a jury trial, at least not, maybe I'll see later on down the road. We found a way, but you can't really have a Zoom jury trial. The way the courtroom is set up is actually designed to make it so that the jurors are the closest possible people to the witnesses. So the jury box is right next to where the witness stand is. So they can be, not only be able to see and hear, but judge body language, tone, inflection,
exactly,
all these things.
Right.
The defendant has a right to have the witnesses That's against
exactly
him or her
a, right.
be able to be judged as completely as possible. And you can't
right.
achieve all that.
So if you did all of that on Zoom or if you tried it, it's entirely possible that those cases, if you got convictions, that they'd be challenged from that constitutional argument, right, about confronting your accuser.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is a good thing. Most Superior
yes.
Court judges are they judge from a position of trying to protect the integrity of the outcome, whether it's a guilty or a not guilty.
Right.
And they so what would very likely happen is that if we tried to have a jury trial, some people have also suggested that we have jury trials where you spread the jury out throughout the gallery of the courtroom. Really same problem, that the jurors
yeah.
would be not be able to see up close the testimony
right.
of the witness. The defendant would likely object. And then the judge is probably likely to sustain that objection because they realize that that could create a
yeah.
appealable issue.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was talking with a relative of mine who's a doctor, and, you know, if money and time are no object, could you design something that would work? And really, you'd have to have something where all 12 jurors were all in glass boxes and had individual airflow systems in and out of their box.
Maxwell Smart.
Right. Exactly.
The dome of silence, right?
Right. And that only gets you through that part. We haven't even talked
right.
about deliberation, how you would have a jury deliberation where you have 12 people in a room around
in
the
a
table
stadium.
Talking.
In a stadium
right.
deliberating. You could
right.
use the Smith Center for deliberations. But yeah, I mean, you could almost envision it if you could go vertical, you know, if you could use like a stadium seating setup or, you know, to
Maybe.
Spread them out, but have them, you know, up higher and whatever. And to imagine the kind of money that it would take to create such a thing, wouldn't it be easier to get a vaccine?
Yes. And you know? Let's back up one more step. That's also just the jury itself. Let's back up to step two, jury selection,
oh, yeah.
the whole jury veneer. We usually typically bring in about 60 to 70 people
yes.
into a jury room. There's the jury lounge where they get
right.
orientation. Then they get brought into the courtroom and they're packed together in the gallery.
Right.
Then they get
right.
selected to be brought out.
Right.
And then you can imagine this, Gene, that, I mean,
I don't have to imagine. I did this actually some years
sure.
ago. Yeah.
And so you it may not surprise you, there's a certain percentage of the jury population that is not exactly ecstatic about being there for jury duty.
What?
Yeah. I know. It's surprising, but
it's shocking.
And so
shocking.
Very often people are sort of looking for a reason to not serve. And so and it would be impossible to parse out this, but you can also imagine that in this time, if you were to bring people, you could see a juror saying, look, I want to do my duty, but I can't be expected to be in this circumstance. I have an 80-year-old mother at home that
right,
I can't
right.
risk. What judge wouldn't grant that excuse?
Wouldn't say to them, oh, okay, yeah. I mean,
right.
you would lose so many people in the jury pool.
It would
well,
happen
I,
really quickly.
I do remember from when I did serve on jury duty. Oh, I don't know when it was. I'm going to say it was 10 years ago at least. And and what happened in my experience was, which I'm sure is quite typical. Jeff is, I'm sure, enjoying watching my cat attack me while I'm talking to him. What happened was that we came in, you know, we went through the process where we're all enjoying each other in that what you generously describe as a lounge. And then we are brought into the courtroom. They interview, I don't know, maybe 20 people for the jury. Then we all go back to the lounge. We wait about maybe 45 minutes or an hour in that case. And then they come in and they say, well, we've reached a plea agreement and the case is going to be resolved and there's not going to be a jury trial. Thank you and goodbye. And everybody goes home and everybody has served. Everybody has served on jury
right.
duty by doing that. And what they told us was that it is the rule, not the exception, that getting to this point is often what gets the attention of the defendant to say, yeah, I guess they're really going to put me on trial here. And what deal can we make to end this? And if they have good attorneys and their attorneys understand their clients, yeah, make the deal, because the trial's really going to happen, and it really is rolling the dice in any trial, as you say. So I think that one thing is, Jeff, that I know and you know, is that a lot of the work that you do is in preventing ever getting to that point. That I think that the DA, and I'd like to talk to about this a little more when we come back. I think that you guys do a lot more to prevent people from getting into that part of the system, to help them resolve their conflicts.
That's true.
Before it ever gets to that point, because the law in this case, when you get to that point of a jury trial and getting convicted of a thing and all that, is kind of a blunt object, and you'd rather do something a little more. You have a lot more flexibility if you're not at the point of in being in a trial.
That's true.
So that's, I think, one of the underappreciated functions of your job, and as I've been fortunate to know you personally, that, you know, it's the helping people part that probably doesn't get enough attention. So we're going to talk more with Jeff when we come back. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. Okay, we are back with Jeff Niemann, who is an assistant district attorney and my favorite guy for Orange and Chatham counties, although Jeff is mainly an Orange County guy. He does turn up in Chatham County periodically, I guess, for shopping and the occasional case that drifts you over there.
Right.
So, Jeff, let's talk about the people helping people element of your job, and how you do this sort of alternative disposition of cases, which is where you have a case in front of you. You have what I guess law and order fans like me would call a prima facie case that a crime has occurred. And you basically, and again, this is much tougher, I would think, because of COVID, but you have kind of a thing where it's time to sit down and say, with the accused and the accused's attorney, and say, this is the case we have, and we think that there's another way to solve, you can see that there's an underlying problem, I guess is what I'm getting at. And that this reminds me, by the way, of future problem solvers. And that if you can kind of imagine taking the end result and working your way back to solve the underlying problem, that what you really want, which I think people generally don't appreciate, what you really want is for this person who's accused to never come back into your office and to get this issue resolved. If they stole something, for example, just to pick one example, did they steal it because they're greedy and they want to steal things, or did they steal something because they're in a desperate situation? There are these mitigating things, including mental health issues, that I think probably help you send that person in a better direction. With, you know, you're not throwing the case out necessarily, but tell us a little bit about how you use things like prayer for judgment and things of this nature to get people redirected into resources that they need, while not ignoring a criminal offense, but maybe resolving the issue without them having a trial and going to jail.
Sure. So I guess I'll just do a brief explanation of kind of what the job is of a district attorney. Our goal is to seek justice. And one thing I found in a conversation I had with somebody who's a highly educated person, but still was surprised, they said, you know, what's it like if you have to prosecute somebody when you know that they're not guilty? And I said, well, actually, it would be against, we can't do that. It would be against our oath to do that. And so, our first assessment, and you brought up the prima facie case idea, but first we do an assessment of, do we believe this person committed the crime? And related, do we think there's sufficient evidence to prove they committed a crime? But let's, for the sake of what you're asking, assume that that's been met, that we do we do believe they committed it and we can prove it. We, you know, I guess you might say that our goal, our responsibility is to seek appropriate accountability for people who have committed crime. But then backing that up a step, it's, in the larger sense, it's crime prevention, right? We want to have a safer community is kind of what our goal is. And so the there are certainly cases where I believe, as much as I am a progressive prosecutor and our office is a progressive office, that justice demands the person receive punishment. And that's, you know, that's the really higher level crimes that, you know, that's, I have had plenty of cases where I firmly believe the right thing is to go to court and to seek a conviction and to seek imprisonment. That's actually a pretty small percentage of the cases that we handle, though, in the total number. It's the ones that, that get a lot of attention. But in a lot of cases, well, the best way to approach it is to look at what the underlying issue is that got the person there in the first place. And most often, I guess I'll put it in three general baskets. One would be, you know, interpersonal conflict. It's people who know each other or having some kind of a conflict. And a lot of times the best thing to do with them is to try to see if we can resolve the conflict. And that can be pre-trial, where the outcome is not a conviction. Sometimes that can be after a plea or a trial, post-conviction. But what we want to do is sometimes, especially on the less serious offenses, is get the accused and the accuser in a room together to actually try to resolve their conflict. And that's where the Dispute Settlement Center comes in, and we engage them on many levels. A lot of people discuss that as being restorative justice, which is something that our office believes strongly in. And that we try to engage restorative justice practices to try to get at that. Another basket, and the next two are big, is a very high percentage of people who have committed crime have some type of substance abuse disorder. And so very often, similarly, it might be pre-trial or it may be post-conviction too, is let's direct this person towards some type of treatment that can try to resolve that. And whether this case results in a conviction or not, what we want to do is try to get the person to where they are in a happier place so that they aren't committing those types of crimes. Or those aren't just drug crimes. There are plenty of crimes that themselves aren't drug crimes, but substance abuse is still the underlying cause of it all. Then related would be mental health. And that would be where someone has a mental health disorder. And that has, and obviously people probably know there are some situations where somebody has a mental health disorder that is so extreme that they actually can't even be prosecuted because they're either,
they're not someone, competent.
They would, and it's, there's two sub things. They're either not, they would be found not guilty by reason of insanity, or they are not competent to stand trial. And those are related, but slightly different things. And so what we do in those cases is try to direct them towards mental health treatment to try to either get them competent or get them to get them treated and safe. You know, I have had some more, in fact, there was one case recently, a very serious case of a murder, an awful murder. And I don't need to talk about the details of it, but it was just about as awful as you can imagine. But every mental health expert, including ours and the defendants, agreed that this person was completely mentally ill to the point where they could not have understood the, what they were doing. And we went into court, and by just consent, basically the judge found the person not guilty by reason of insanity. Now that situation, that person still poses a public health danger because of how severe the person's mental health problem was. So that person still essentially was taken off the streets, but they weren't sent to prison. They were sent to a mental health hospital where they'll be held and evaluated, and they'll be continually. So anyway, there's a wide spectrum of where the mental health and the substance abuse and the conflict resolution do, but we do try to seek other ways aside from the traditional go to court, have a trial, someone gets sent to prison route, because our goal is bigger than just fixing the problem of this case. It's trying to prevent long-term recidivism and, you know, keep the community safe.
And I assume that you keep some form of statistics on how these cases turn out? No, you don't? Okay.
Well, I mean,
it wouldn't be that easy, I don't think.
No, we do, and we're working on systems for that. But it's actually harder to keep.
I would think, yeah.
Hard statistics. You know, statistics are difficult in the criminal justice system because of the way that, because there's so many permutations of a way a case can be resolved.
Right.
That
right.
fitting it neatly into statistical models is tough. But yeah. So I can't really quote for you statistics here that would kind of tell you.
Oh, no, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't ask you to. I guess what I was wondering is, I think that I look at this thing with COVID, and I think that, in 5 years, we're going to know some fascinating things about our society because of what happened with COVID, about, for example, how working life has changed for people. And like I said, just look at it in the simplest terms, fewer car accidents. How are people managing stress? Are they more stressed because they're home almost all the time? Or are they less stressed because they don't have an hour commute in bumper to bumper traffic that's driving them crazy? Which, you know, a lot of people have really complained mightily about that for a long time and wanted to have the opportunity to work from home at least some part of the week. And now that they have done it and their businesses have seen that people can be quite productive when they work from home, and they're not spending any commute time, so there's not that lost productivity. How will the workforce writ large change? And I think it might be dramatic, but I don't think that we'll know until some years from now when things can return to quote unquote normal, whatever that means. I think that we're going to learn really interesting things. And this area is one of those things, like maybe the kind of rejiggering of figuring out what cases are of the highest priority and have to go to court. Maybe a similar prioritization can be ongoing.
Well, a couple thoughts on that. One is, I hadn't touched on this before, despite the fact that we can't have jury trials, we actually have found that we're able to do, as I alluded to before, most cases do get resolved through some type of compromise right. or plea agreement. We can do those by WebEx, and we are.
I've had cases
that have been resolved where I'm sitting in my office or even at my kitchen table.
Right.
On a WebEx, the judge is in his living room. The
right.
defense attorney is in her living room. The defendant is on their phone in their
right.
living room. The
right.
clerk is there, and we have the whole thing happen the way it normally happens. It's all the way you and I are talking now over
right.
some kind of webcam.
Yeah.
So we can do that. I will say this. You were kind of alluding to a lot of the positive externalities of the fact that we're not out in the world, you know, banging into each other as much. How I will say, and you're right, the time will tell. I do think that there are some negative externalities that too.
Right.
I think that there's a lot of positive that comes from us visit, you know, in-person human interaction is an important
right.
part
right.
of, and so I think we do need to find a balance of the advantages that we're gaining from this new
right.
world, but I don't want us to go to a world where we're only interacting with people over computer screens completely, of course. You know?
I completely agree. And I of course, there's also a lot of concern about increasing rates and maybe not such good reporting of child abuse and other forms of domestic abuse that are maybe the cases aren't as high right now, but that's so much more likely to be a lack of reporting because of lack of contact with other people.
Absolutely.
And we all know that our families can make us a little loopy after a time.
Right.
So if you take that to an extreme there, yeah, it can be some bad stuff. We're going to take our last break and we're going to come right back. We're talking with Jeff Niemann from the district attorney's office, who's keeping us all safe and driving in the paint. A lot of the time. You're listening to The Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back with our closing moments with ADA Jeff Niemann, who, by the way, is a great friend of WCHL. If I ever say anything wrong at the Aaron Keck show, there's going to be a text right away correcting me. and Aaron, while we're on the air, is going to hold up his phone, which, by the way, please admire my phone that says on the back, I voted.
All right.
Turned in my ballot, mine and Rick's, on Friday. And I take every possible opportunity to tell everybody, if you're going to drop off your ballot at the Board of Elections in Hillsborough, do it. It's fast. It's easy. It's very safe. They have a very simple and completely safe process. Bring your mask. You'll have to go inside the building, but otherwise I don't want to say quick and dirty because that gives a wrong impression, but it's fast and easy and everybody should vote, vote, vote. Okay, Jeff, tell me about how they're doing things in terms of managing the population at the jail and keeping those folks safe. And how the clerk and the other operations at the courthouse that are probably kind of behind the scenes to some extent for the public. Tell me how those folks are handling things and take all the time you need. We have 5 minutes.
All right. Well, so having this discussion, we can't ignore that there was another large kind of inflection point in our society that happened almost exactly the same time. And that was the murder of George Floyd and all the discussions coming from that. And they intersect in a lot of ways. So partly that being in the atmosphere as well, we have reduced our jail population by about 75% since March.
Wow.
So it is a fraction of what it formerly was. And as a result, we have not had any serious problem of COVID in our jail because it's not this packed area. And so maybe people don't know is the jail is actually, generally speaking, there's some exceptions, but most people who are in jail are people who are awaiting trial. Usually once people get sentenced to prison time, once they're convicted, they go to the prison. So what that means is that we are using a lot of tools for where people are awaiting trial. I'll get just the brief version of it is that it's not simply a binary thing. It's not that they're either in jail or they're out. There's in jail. And right now, generally speaking, the people being held in jail are only people who are charged with the most serious crimes and or have a repeated demonstrated history of not showing up to court when they're given the voluntary opportunity. And that where that line is has moved far to the not jail part. And that's how we've gotten to the jail population being so small. But we do have a lot of tools for people kind of along the lines of what we talked about before. We can have somebody out of jail, but they work with our pretrial release services, which can provide a lot of services to kind of do multiple things, including helping keep people just reminded about going to their court date. Just the act of them needing to check in with them regularly keeps that in their mind. So it makes it more likely they'll come to court. They can connect them with mental health and substance abuse services while they're awaiting trial. So we can start attacking the underlying issue while it's going. If it's a more serious case, that's not quite a jail case, but still there might be a public safety concern, then they can be out of jail, but have some kind of electronic monitoring that allows them to be out and about, but so that pretrial release can keep kind of tabs on them and know that they're not going, say, near the victim's home or that kind of thing. That's one thing that's big that we're doing. And then the clerk's office has done amazing things. Mark Kleinschmidt, who you know, who's the clerk of court, and his staff have really transformed, and I should say the sheriff's staff that are the bailiffs, they're kind of the main actors that kind of manage the courthouse population. And so you go in the courthouse, it looks completely different from the way it looked before. There's arrows all over the floors. There's way to manage people coming in and out. There's glass at all the clerk's offices. There's ways that people can come in and do their clerk's business kind of at the front, so they don't have to go all the way deeply into the courthouse. There's all kinds of online services to allow people to do things, if possible, remotely instead of coming in. So they've done some pretty amazing things on both those fronts to make things safe. Nobody comes in the courthouse without a mask on. We run a pretty safe courthouse, I would say. sorry, I had to climb some stairs in the middle of that answer.
Jeff has just run up a flight of stairs in the middle of saying all of that, which is telling you, everybody, what great shape you're in.
Yeah, sure.
Well, I think all of that is fantastic. And we were just talking during the break about the fact that, you know, when you do help people on the front end and you bring them to a contract where they take certain steps and their case will be dismissed later on, that you don't tend to see the positive outcomes. And let me just, on behalf of all those people, tell you that I think you guys do a fantastic job. I think you don't get enough praise for these things that you do that are preventive, that help keep people out of the criminal justice system. I think the negative things, when they pop up, it is very much like parenting, that you tend to focus on the no, stop, that, you know, your mind focuses naturally on the no, stop that, put that down, you'll hurt yourself kind of things that we all run into as parents. But all of the positive things that you do that help people to restore their lives to being productive and safe and more normal, I think that you probably don't get that put in front of you enough. So let me tell you, on behalf of our community, that we appreciate you and really appreciate all of the extra steps that you've had to take to manage this this operation during a time of challenge that I think nobody fully understands yet how big and devastating it's been. And Lord knows what it's all going to cost in the end. But I really appreciate what you're doing. And Jeff, keep up the good work and take good care of yourself and your family and all your coworkers come back on the water cooler and give us updates if things change, for better or worse. We're always happy to hear from you. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Gene. Good to be here.
All right. Everybody go off and have a great weekend, what's left of it. And you've been listening to the Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill.
Follow Gene on Twitter at Gene Bolduc and tweet your comments and questions with the hashtag WCHL.